Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Killer Lies by Chris Collett. Narrated by Liam Gerard. Chapter 1. Chugging along through the dense, dark early morning, Tim Leavis was counting off the days. It was less than a week now to the winter solstice, when they'd begin to lengthen again. Much as he liked his life, he'd never got used to these early winter starts, and this one was earlier than most, allowing him to feed the animals, but still get back for a shower and breakfast before driving across to the village school in time to see Archie perform in the nativity play. The boy had been typecast as a shepherd, of course, though pointing out the likely effects on the animals' bodily functions had, at least, dissuaded Mrs. Elliot from her romantic idea of having his son carry a newborn lamb across the stage. Passing a local beauty spot, the powerful beams of the John Deere's headlights picked up a small creature, scuttling across the road, then glinted back at him, reflecting off something shiny, the radiator grille of a car parked in the lay-by. From what he could tell, it was a big car, black, though Leavis didn't immediately recognise the make. Someone else with an early start, or, more likely, returning late from some pre-Christmas revelry. The driver's door hung open, and Leavis smiled to himself. Not the first motorist to use the woods as a convenient convenience. Better be quick, mate. Cold enough this morning to freeze your tadger off. But when Leavis returned 20 minutes later, after depositing the hay in the sheep field, the vehicle was still there. Coming up behind the car this time, he could see that the boot was also open. The driver was crouching on the road behind the vehicle, peering underneath. Exhaust problems, perhaps. Hoping that it wouldn't take too long, Leavis pulled his tractor into the lay-by to offer his assistance. That was when he realised that the figure wasn't so much crouching as lying inanimate on the frozen ground. And suddenly, more than the air felt chill. In the dark, the Socco almost missed it. The arc lights that had been brought in were trained on the man and woman in the rear passenger seat of the limousine, their posture so natural they could have been calmly waiting for their driver to return so that they could continue their journey. As long as you didn't look at their faces and the identical black holes that had ripped apart each forehead, spraying grey, fleshy pebble dashing across the rear window behind them. It was an efficient job, a high-velocity weapon fired at point-blank range. One shot apiece. The victims would have had mere seconds to grasp what was happening. And the assassin had, on first examination, left nothing behind. No stray prints, hairs or fibres evident at this stage, though the car would get a more comprehensive going over once it was back at the lab. Fortunately, the farmer who'd discovered the gruesome scene had seen enough detective shows to know not to touch anything. Colleagues working around the third dead body, sprawled on the road beside the gaping trunk, were having more luck. Underneath the boot lining in the spare wheel cavity, they'd found traces of a white, powdery residue. Edging out of the vehicle, the Socco made one last sweep with his maglite and caught a momentary glimpse of something. Something that had been veiled by the intense glare of the spotlights. 25 semi-transparent letters inscribed on the glass of the passenger window in a reddish-brown hue. The author had clearly made use of the raw materials at hand. Every third letter was bolder than the others. The index finger dipped into its bloody inkwell at even intervals until the message was complete. "Mom?" The Socco ducked his head out and addressed the woman waiting patiently beside the car in the frigid air. "They've left us a message." DCI Caroline Griffin stepped forward, removing her gloved hands from the pockets of her long wool coat. She leaned into the car as the Socco moved his beam along the communication. "Vengeance is mine. I will repay." "Not particularly subtle," she remarked. "Or original," added the Socco. Chapter 2. There was a first time for everything. Mariner humming along to Slade, singing "Merry Christmas, Everybody." Normally the song made him cringe, but this year apparently signalled a shift in his tolerance levels. Dylan's "The Times They Are a-Changin'" would have been more appropriate. Christmas shopping wasn't something Mariner did either, but here he was, doing it on his own, completely unprompted and in grave danger of looking like a new man. It was mostly illusion, though. Mariner's underlying motive was rooted in the hope that an hour of exposing his senses to the garishness of Christmas might help him to shake off the image that had stayed with him since early this morning, when he'd stood knee-deep in an underground sewer, watching a police constable cut open a bound bin liner to reveal the decaying body of a woman. So far, the strategy hadn't been wholly successful, but he had another 15 minutes before he was due to meet Anna and the others. Another 15 minutes to distance himself. So he slipped into Waterstone's bookshop. In here, the atmosphere was calm, the background chamber music a notch more sophisticated, but nonetheless contrived, along with the aroma of real coffee to soothe him into parting with some of his hard-earned cash. And for a while, Colombian medium roast vied with the smell of raw waste that lingered in his nostrils. Like everywhere else Mariner had been in the Bullring, the shop was excessively warm, and he sweltered in his overcoat, another rule broken. Overcoats weren't his style, but Anna had persuaded him into one last winter, and today it had come into its own, keeping him warm and helpfully concealing the uniform underneath. He strolled around, scanning the 3-for-2 bestseller tables, and loitering over the latest wave of women's fiction that Anna was so partial to, and that invariably featured feisty, independent-spirited females. This year she'd probably have preferred a volume from the health section, under pregnancy planning and parents-to-be, but somehow Mariner couldn't quite bring himself to move towards that corner of the shop. Instead, he picked up a couple of what looked like the most popular of the chick-lit titles, with their ubiquitous fluorescent cartoon covers, and took them over to the counter. The checkout queue was long, the customers ahead of him apparently starting up their own private libraries, and for some time Mariner found himself standing beside a stack of glossy hardbacks, the early memoirs of former MP Sir Geoffrey Ryland. Not ordinarily popular reading matter, but there were no prizes for guessing the reason for their prominence today. Just 1 week ago, Ryland had met a violent end, ambushed and shot dead in his car on a quiet Oxfordshire lane. Mariner absently picked up a copy of the book and skimmed the jacket. One of the Good Guys. Not on the face of it an attention-grabbing title, even though it might be true. Joe Public didn't want to read about politicians who'd done the job well. They wanted the scandal, like Alan Clark's love affairs. Sales of Bill Clinton's autobiography had gone through the roof. Everyone wanting to know the sordid truth about Monica Lewinsky. And that dress. The flyleaf told Mariner little more than he already knew, tracing Ryland's professional life as a human rights lawyer in the 1960s to his natural progression into politics as an MP for an inner-city London borough. A specialist in miscarriages of justice at a time when they were rife, he'd given up his parliamentary seat to chair one of the government's most prized flagship institutions, the Judicial Review Commission, the job for which Ryland had received his knighthood. According to the news reports, Ryland had died at the age of 68. No age at all. Only the good die young.
You taking that one too?
The paperbacks were lifted from his grasp, and Mariner looked up to see that he'd reached the head of the queue, to be greeted by a sales girl name-tagged Nicky.
"We were all set to send them back to the warehouse," she told him. "But they're practically walking off the shelves now. You wouldn't believe what a sudden death can do for a writer."
"Or a musician,"
her mate chipped in from the neighbouring till.
"When John Lennon got shot, Imagine went straight to number one."
"Turned James Dean into a legend overnight," agreed Mariner. They both looked at him blankly. "The film actor?" he elaborated. "Rebel without a cause?"
"Oh, yeah," Nicky's friend said vaguely. "I think I've heard of him." "So are you taking it?"
Nicky got back to the hard sell.
"Might be a good present for someone."
A year ago it would have been perfect. Had his mother still been alive, Mariner would have bought it for her. Ryland was one of a group of charismatic social reformers of her generation whom, alongside Bruce Kent and Nelson Mandela, she'd idolised. In fact, that's just how she'd have described all three. The good guys. Go on, then. Mariner put the book down on the counter.
Good for you, Nicky grinned. You won't regret it.
I should hope not, said Mariner, especially at that price.
You've even got an autographed one.
She flipped open the cover, displaying an illegible scrawl.
He came in for a signing in November, and we had some left over.
So you met Ryland? Mariner pulled his credit card from his wallet.
Yes.
And did you think he was?
Mariner asked,
as they waited for the transaction to process.
Was what?
One of the good guys. She shrugged.
He was very polite, and his driver thought a lot of him. He came out back for a fag, so I got talking to him.
Ryland had got him out of prison, so he thought the old man was a hero. Mariner considered what he'd read about the recent shooting. Word was that the killings were down to the driver. Not a nice way to repay your hero. Taking the bulging plastic carrier bag from the girl called Nicky, and feeling slightly as if he'd been had, Mariner stepped away from the counter and felt a tingling sensation along his spine. He turned sharply and scoped the shop, but the handful of other customers either had their noses buried in books or were studying the shelves. He'd caught no one out. It had come on him suddenly, this sensation that he was being watched. He'd had the same experience several times during the last few weeks, though he'd told no one about it. They'd have suggested therapy. He put the feeling down to being tired. It was a long time since he'd had a holiday. Mariner had arranged to meet Anna, along with D.S. Tony Knox, at the visiting Frankfurt Christmas market, and he picked up the tail end of the colourful stalls on New Street. As he progressed deeper into the market, the ambience subtly changed, the hard-nosed consumerism of the department stores giving way to a mellower side of Christmas. Under less pressure to buy, shoppers browsed the pastry and pottery stalls exchanging pleasantries, and the easy banter between the vendors created an atmosphere of genuine goodwill. This year there had been a clumsy effort by some local councillors to replace the market with a more patriotic English version. But somehow Mariner couldn't imagine that hot dogs and burgers would be an improvement. If he could only forget what he'd been doing all day. The busiest stands were those grouped below the steps of the museum and art gallery, offering a range of exotic refreshments. It was here that Mariner spied Tony Knox, beneath one of the food bar parasols, his arm draped round a woman, the latest girlfriend he'd heard so much about, Selina, if his recall was accurate. So many had come and gone since Knox's wife had left him that Mariner couldn't be sure. The pulling power of the middle-aged divorcee was one of life's mysteries.
"All right, boss?"
Knox asked as Mariner arrived at his side. The two men shook hands as Knox disentangled himself.
"This is Selina," he said without ceremony. "Selina, D.I. Tom Mariner."
First impressions were that this girl's model good looks carbon-copied her predecessors, Knox continuing his quest for the antithesis to his ex. Slim and leggy in jeans and sheepskin bomber jacket, Selina's hair was pinned up in an explosion of lethal blonde spikes, and the total image was straight off a page of the glossies. But the smile, when it came, was pure mischief.
"The boss,"
she grinned, one perfectly shaped eyebrow arching.
"I've heard all about you."
The stress on that last word implied that she knew rather more than Mariner would have liked, but at the same time he couldn't help warming to Selina. "You too," he said automatically. "Tony said you're an accountant." As the snippet of information came back to him, Mariner struggled momentarily to square the image with the occupation.
"Try not to sound quite so surprised," Selina said, reading his face. "We're not all fat and balding in a suit, you know."
"So I see."
"And she's a Blues supporter,"
Knox put in, "so I wouldn't go getting too friendly." "Well, nobody's perfect," Mariner conceded. Knox passed him a mug of steaming glühwein.
"Judge Courage," he said. Or should that be German courage? I thought you might need it.
He raised his own mug, slipping an arm back around Selina and drawing her closer.
Prost!
Prost! Prost! The three mugs clinked together.
As long as I don't end up slurring my words, said Mariner, might not look good.
But at the same time he was trying to ignore the growing flutter of butterfly wings in his stomach. Standing up in front of the chief constable and other luminaries along with 100 or so of his colleagues wasn't something he was often asked to do, even if tonight he would only be reading from the Gospel according to St. Luke. It said something for the heathens at the Granville Lane OCU that it was Mariner, lifelong agnostic, who was representing them by doing a reading at the Force Carol service, though his participation came only as a result of having his arm twisted up his back by Jack Coleman.
It shouldn't even be me who's up there, he grumbled. The job should have gone to a good Catholic boy.
Lapsed Catholic boy, Knox reminded him. And I was never a contender. The Brummie masses wouldn't understand a word I said, like...
And to demonstrate, he thickened his Scouse accent to a series of guttural spasms.
They heard Anna before they saw her, cheerfully apologising her way through what was becoming a tightly packed crowd. The mellow light accentuated the paleness of her skin, while highlighting the copper tones of her shoulder-length hair. Watching her progress, eliciting smiles and good-natured teasing along the way, Mariner was reminded what a lucky bugger he was. Then he saw what she was carrying. He'd been feeling pretty virtuous about his purchases, but Anna appeared to have bought out Toys R Us single-handed.
"Doing your bit for the national economy,"
Knox joked, relieving her of two enormous carrier bags and stacking them out of the way.
"I'll get you a drink."
"Thanks, Tony." Reaching up, Anna planted a kiss on Mariner.
"It's just a few bits and pieces."
"Can't guess who they're for," Mariner said.
"Tony didn't tell me you had children," Selina said.
"Anna, this is Selina," said Mariner, taking his cue.
"Hi."
Anna mirrored the smile.
"We haven't yet, but sometime soon."
Her words triggered a bubble of anxiety in Mariner's stomach. He wished she wouldn't talk as if it were a done deal, when they'd only just started weighing up the pros and cons. It was a big shift for both of them, and he, at least, was still getting used to the idea. When he'd first met her, kids were the last thing Anna had wanted. She'd got a successful career and a severely autistic brother, a combination guaranteed to dampen the strongest maternal instincts. But during the last year, events had conspired to change her mind. 2 months ago, Jamie had moved into a hostel for independent living and was doing just that, leaving Anna with time and energy on her hands. Concurrently, Anna's best friend Becky had produced baby daughter Megan, waking Anna up to the fact that time might be running out. And from then on, babies had insidiously crept into everyday conversation. Gradually, without overt discussion, children had moved from being out of the question to a possibility, and, more recently, a probability. For his own part, Mariner had never been so much opposed to children as ignorant of them. His mother, his only close blood relative, had passed away last year, leaving him practically alone in the world, but for a few distant cousins he'd never met. He and Anna had something good together, so in many ways children seemed like the next natural step. It was only after he'd agreed to consider it that the doubts had begun, and Anna had been so euphoric these last few weeks that now he couldn't bear to spoil it for her.
"You're jumping the gun," he cautioned. "We haven't had the appointment through yet."
Anna caught Selina's bemused look.
"My brother has autism," she explained, "so we're being referred to a counsellor."
It had been Mariner's suggestion, partly to test out how serious she was.
"There are known genetic links, so we need to think through the implications of that."
"Better to be informed," Selina agreed. "Not that it'll make a scrap of difference," Mariner said. "Once Anna's made up her mind about something..."
"We'd need to be prepared for what might happen," Anna said, dodging the issue. "Meanwhile, the gifts are for my goddaughter, Megan. It's her first Christmas, so she has to be spoiled rotten." How old is she? 4 months, and I just can't get enough of her. Well, I can't recommend it too highly. Selina enthused. I've got a 3-month-old.
Anna must have been as floored as Mariner, because suddenly they were in the middle of an awkward silence. Knox's own kids were adults themselves now, and he'd always expressed huge relief that he'd put the nappy changing and the sleepless nights behind him long ago. And what kind of woman leaves her 3-month baby at home to go out dating?
Selina laughed, a peal of uninhibited joy.
You should see your faces, she giggled. You can relax. My baby's of the canine variety, she said. A chocolate Labrador is something less of a commitment.
You must still have your hands full, said Anna, as Knox returned and passed round fresh drinks.
I have to admit, life will be easier once he's stopped piddling on the floor and chewing my tights.
It will help when the dog's trained too, added Mariner.
Hilarious, said Knox. You two should book a spot at the Glee Club.
Mariner and Selina exchanged a complicit smile. This could be fun. After the warming drinks, they queued for herb-fried potatoes and onions, finding themselves a quiet corner to eat from the flimsy paper plates. The food smelled and tasted delicious, but somehow the visual, brown, moist and indistinct, deadened Mariner's appetite. Knox saw his face.
"Brings back memories, does it, boss?" he asked, shoveling in a mouthful. "Charlie Glover told me you'd been knee-deep in shit all morning."
"Thanks," said Mariner, throwing Selina and Anna an apologetic look. "Not the most fun I've ever had." Mariner put down his plate untouched.
"You're not eating that?"
asked Knox, helping himself. The two women were watching Mariner expectantly.
"You don't want to know," he said.
"Yes, we do. You have to tell us now."
Mariner sighed, all his earlier efforts undone.
"Workmen found a blockage down one of the main sewers in Sturchley," he said. "It turned out to be the body of a woman wrapped in bin liners and bound with duct tape. We had to go down there to check it out in situ."
He saw Anna's grimace.
"There, aren't you glad I told you?"
"I hope you've showered since. Have you got an ID?"
Knox asked, garlic wafting Mariner's way.
"Not yet, but we've got a good set of prints from her. Whoever put her down the drain didn't count on her being found."
"So it would seem. Charlie Glover's trawling through the recent missing persons. Otherwise, we have to hope she's committed a crime that's put her on criminal."
In the time Mariner had been speaking, Knox had polished off both portions of food.
"We should go, shouldn't we?"
said Selina, collecting up the used plates and depositing them in a nearby bin.
"Yeah, not all of us have the luxury of reserved seats," said Knox.
"Not all of us have got to stand up and make pillocks of ourselves," countered Mariner.
"You'll be wonderful, darling."
To Mariner's surprise, Selina grasped his arms, giving him a Hollywood-style peck on each cheek.
"I'm fluttered by your confidence," said Mariner.
Anna was scanning the stalls around them.
"I just want to get one of those little springy puppets for Megan first," she said.
Mariner started to retrieve all the carrier bags.
"Ah, yes, because she hasn't got nearly enough already."
"We'll see you down there, then,"
Selina said, and, taking Knox's arm, she flashed them a parting smile as the two of them headed off towards the main street, their arms snaked around each other, fusing their bodies together as one.
"Do you think it might be the real thing this time?" Mariner said, watching them go.
"She's lasted longer than any of the others," said Anna. "And Tony can't keep his hands off her.
She's a bright girl, too. I don't know how he does it."
"Confidence," said Anna. "Women find it irresistible."
"Including you?"
Anna shook her head.
"Nah, I just have a weak spot for the underdog."
"Thanks."
"We could have waited," said Knox mildly. "We've got loads of time, and it won't be a full house."
He and Selina were crossing Corporation Street on their way to St. Martin's. She cuddled up closer.
I wanted you to myself for a bit. I still don't know why we're spending the evening in a dreary church when we could be at home making our own entertainment. I'm showing a bit of solidarity, Nock said. He'd explained all this before. But he's your boss, said Selina. Isn't it a bit strange to want to socialise with him? He's been a good mate, too. Was he friends with Teresa? Not friends, exactly. He knew her, that's all. Well, it'll be a different story once they've got a family. And, seemingly satisfied with her own resolution to whatever the issue was, she squeezed him tight. There was no such intimacy for Mariner and Anna when they followed on, bearing the bulky carrier bags. They had to settle for an awkward linking of arms, the baby paraphernalia keeping them 18 inches apart. "What the hell have you got in here?" Mariner grumbled, as he apologised yet again for colliding with a passerby.
"You wouldn't be any the wiser if I told you. It's just toys for Megan. It's not much, but everything's jumbo-sized at her age."
"You're telling me? They'll cost a fortune in postage."
"I was planning to take them down," said Anna, casually. "I thought I'd go at the weekend."
"You were only down there a couple of weeks ago." Some time ago, Becky, her GP husband Mark, and their small daughter had moved to a country practice in rural Herefordshire. Thus far, the geography hadn't proved a deterrent.
"Is that resentment?"
"Of course not.
I'm her godmother," she said, as though he hadn't just denied it. "I have to spend time with her. Everything happens so fast at her age. I might miss something. Besides, I've got a lot to learn."
"It's all right," said Mariner. "You don't have to justify yourself."
"You could come too. You haven't even met Megan yet. I don't know why."
"It's been busy at work." It wasn't the whole truth, but he wondered if Anna realised that. At 7 in the evening, the main shopping centre was still swarming with people as Anna and Mariner, with their clumsy arm-in-arm arrangement, strolled towards St. Martin's Church, past the bronze bull, while the armour-plated bulge of Selfridges came gradually into view, like the prow of a slow-moving liner. The church had been retained as a focal point for the massive redevelopment of the Bullring area, and tonight it was stunningly lit by floodlights, the dark spire nestling dramatically between the concrete and glass, and the burned Jones stained glass windows crimson against the twinkling urban landscape. Above the hubbub around them, Mariner could just make out the sound of the West Midlands Police Service brass band, playing the opening bars of the first carol, "O Little Town of Bethlehem." Mariner felt contented and at ease, and, for the first time for as long as he could remember, some excited anticipation of the Christmas season. He turned to Anna to tell her. As he did, there was a flash of blinding light as an explosion ripped the air between them like a thunderbolt. A scorching tornado punched him back off his feet, tearing the smile from his face and Anna's arm from his. He heard Anna's scream above the deafening crack of imploding plate glass before slamming heavily onto his back, his head bouncing off the stone slabs. Everything seemed to stop for a second, 2, 3, 4. Then, as the ringing in his ears subsided, sounds invaded his consciousness. People were screaming and running, alarms were blaring. Opening his eyes, Mariner slowly, painfully raised his head. The world was unnaturally dark and hushed, and the air tasted of dust. The church that had been so magnificently lit only moments before was hazy, behind a cloud of smoke, the dark silhouette of its tower emerging shakily defiant at one end. It was like a war zone. Mariner fumbled for his phone, his hands and fingers clumsy and unresponsive. Gagging on the powdery air, it took him 3 attempts to force out the words.
"D.I. Mariner, Granville Lane. There's been an explosion in St. Martin's. All emergency services needed urgently."
Turning, he saw Anna, prone and still on the ground nearby, and a hot wave of panic surged through him.
"Anna!"
he shouted hoarsely. After what seemed like an eternity, she looked round at him,
and a weak smile split her dirt-caked face. I'm okay.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?